Welcome, I'm Jesse Uliberry, Co-Executive Director of the State Innovation Exchange, a national resource and strategy center, ensuring that state legislators are working side by side with our movements to improve people's lives through transformative public policy. Today, we're talking with experts about the rise in anti-transgender legislation we're seeing in state legislatures across the country. As a former legislator myself and as a queer person of color, we see these as a direct attack on our communities. We know that these bills are an attack on basic dignity and humanity of transgender youth, and prohibiting youth from playing on certain sports teams or making it harder or impossible to receive adequate medical care. Before I introduce our experts, I want to remind folks to reach out to us at helpdesk@stateinnovation.org. If you'd like to follow up with us, want additional resources, or have any questions, we are here to help. First, I'd like to introduce Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Transgender Justice with the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project, a nationally recognized expert on transgender rights. And if you don't follow him on Twitter, you should. He has a wonderful bill tracker about the state of transgender rights in state legislatures. Chase will give us an overview of what we're seeing in state houses across the country and give us context for why these bills are harmful. Next, we'll hear from Katrina Karkazis from the Global Health Justice Partnership at Yale University, who is a cultural anthropologist working at the intersection of science and technology studies, theories of gender and race, and social studies of medicine and bioethics. And Katrina will dispel the myth that testosterone levels are a sufficient basis for prohibiting youth athletes from playing on their gender-identifying sports teams. And we're honored to have Rep. Carlos Guillermo Smith, who will talk with us about what it's like to face these bills head-on daily in the state legislature in Florida. So Chase, what's happening around the country and why are these bills so harmful?
Yeah, so thank you, Jesse, for convening us. This is such an important conversation. I've been doing work to fight anti-trans bills in state legislatures for the past 5 years, at least, and this year in 2020 is by far the most extreme year in terms of both the volume of bills targeting the trans community as well as the substance of these bills. So over the past many years, we've seen an escalation of attacks on trans people, and a lot of these have been targeting trans youth, which of course is devastating because trans young people are already an incredibly vulnerable population. So if you imagine a community that already has disparities in outcome, health outcomes, high rates of suicidality, high rates of bullying in schools, to think that the government is in a position to try to exacerbate those conditions rather than minimize them is deeply troubling. This year, what we're seeing are two main types of bills. One type of bill is aimed at access to healthcare for transgender youth. These bills that we've seen across the country in at least 13 states would either criminalize or otherwise ban medically accepted healthcare for transgender young people. And the rhetoric around these bills is incredibly misleading. None of the bills are driven by medicine. None of the bills are driven by the needs of the transgender community. And the notion that it would be appropriate for the government to step in and make it a crime for people to maintain their healthcare that is recommended by every major medical association is just devastating for our communities. And then the second type of bill, which we're seeing now in 17 states, are bills that would bar transgender young people and other transgender athletes from participating in sports. And these bills are often crafted under the rhetoric of protecting women and girls, but the reality is that the way these bills are written is so incredibly extreme that it would expand the policing of the bodies of all women and girls. So for example, the model bill that we're really seeing in most places would mandate genetic, chromosomal, and genital checks of young women and girls in order to allow participation in athletics. So these are incredibly extreme measures that would have such a significant reach in their impact and invade the equality rights, the privacy rights, the basic dignity of so many people, but particularly trans young people, in ways that will be absolutely catastrophic to their health and well-being. So we're fighting these bills at the ACLU. We have a bill tracker on our website. You can follow at ACLU on Twitter, on Instagram, my personal Twitter at Chase Strangio. Also, I try to keep up information about where these bills are because we are continuing to see them coming in, and it is a great threat to our community.
Thank you, Chase. It is incredibly dangerous. And so we want Katrina to weigh in here. We want to hear and understand more about how these bills are making a dangerous case and trying to use biology to harm trans youth. So particularly, what are they saying and how is it harmful?
Yeah, so a couple of things. There's a long history of actually trying to restrict women's eligibility in sport. And that's variously been called sex testing, gender verification. And this has been going on for decades, but one of the key problems, and it's what these bills really are reintroducing, if you will, into the realm of sport, is this idea that there is some clear and straightforward physiological advantage that men typically have over women, and that this applies not only to cisgender individuals, but to trans individuals. And often, but not always, these kinds of claims rest on the idea that testosterone itself and the presumption of higher levels in men make a kind of miracle molecule of athleticism that propels men to the podium. And there are a couple of problems with this. First of all, there are competitive advantages everywhere in sport. And that can be anything from training and nutrition. That can be differences in height, where height is a really great example because there's more variation among women in height than there is between men and women. But people don't question that as a kind of advantage. But more often than not, what we're seeing is testosterone. And testosterone is not at all the key to one superior performance. It's an important factor, but there are a couple of myths that go along with this. One idea is that men's and women's levels are distinct. And so therefore, there's this big no man's land, if you will, between those levels. That's actually not true. Testosterone levels overlap between humans. It's a bell curve with some people more at one end than the other. Because of that, that really complicates the idea that testosterone is what drives men ahead, because in some cases, higher testosterone levels are not those who are winning and on the podium, right? And so you can have men who have low levels, women who have high levels. None of this is atypical or problematic, but it oversimplifies what we know about testosterone levels in humans. There are a range of other physiological factors that are important to sport, but the idea is that you cannot use testosterone to predict who will do better. You can't assume that people who do better have higher testosterone levels, and you can't presume that testosterone over any other physiological factor, social factor, environmental factor is what makes the better athlete. But these assumptions are very sedimented and old. People think of it as very common sense wisdom. They're surprised to hear that there's no obvious pattern and that it's an incredibly dynamic hormone that once again is important, but is not the determining factor. And just for a very kind of straightforward example, maybe a couple more points. Transgender individuals at the elite level of sport have been allowed in, for example, the Olympics since 2003. What that means is over the last almost two decades, we've never had a single transgender individual compete in the Olympics. So this overarching narrative that somehow, especially trans women, are going to dominate women's sport, it's just not borne out by the evidence. It's not always the case that transgender women and girls win. They lose just as their cisgender competitors lose. So it's not the case that puberty or higher testosterone levels is what propels people to the top. The final comment I would really want to make, and this echoes what Chase said, these are really draconian bills that go far beyond even the kinds of regulations that are happening at the elite level of sport. They harken back to an earlier time of sex testing or gender verification, where policymakers themselves, athletes, commissions, and medical professionals weighed in to say, not only is this unscientific, it's invasive, it's humiliating, it goes far beyond the kind of medical exams and investigations that any woman should be required to undergo in order to compete. So what these lawmakers are proposing is far beyond anything that exists even at the elite level, where there's a tremendous amount at stake gold medals, sponsorships, any number of other things. And it continues that really devastating and discriminatory history of sport regulations that have since been abandoned at that higher level, around invasive bodily exams, gender ideologies that create judgments about particular bodies, the narrowing of the category of, you know, who can be a woman based on outdated and biased unscientific information.
Thank you, Katrina. Very helpful information. So we're hearing a clear through line. Challenges humanity and doesn't stand up to science and actually doesn't comport with other sports pieces within the broader elite field of sports. Rep Smith, we'd love to hear from you as what tools as a legislator have you used to combat these types of legislation, and what else might you need to be helpful on the ground?
Thank you again, Jesse. Again, my name is Carlos Guillermo Smith. I'm a state representative in the Florida House of Representatives from Orlando, and we have experience in our state legislature with having to beat back anti-LGBTQ, but also specifically anti-transgender legislation. And earlier this session, just a month ago, we had to fight a bill that made it a crime for doctors or healthcare professionals to provide healthcare services to transgender youth. What I found in our experience, because we were able to kill the bill for this legislative session and stop it from moving forward, the strongest tool that we had in our tool chest was the families of trans youth and also trans youth themselves who traveled far and wide from across the state of Florida to come to Tallahassee to tell their story. They talked about how having access to life-saving healthcare that would otherwise be criminalized in the legislation being proposed, that having access to that care essentially helped save their life. And that these were very, very powerful stories that members of the committee, both Republican and Democrat, heard. And I think it really, really resonated with them. That was the most important tool that we had, but certainly we're sensing a theme with so many of these bills that aim to block access to life-saving care. What we're finding is that they are bringing fake doctors and organizations that have been known and declared as hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center to come and justify some of the bogus claims that they are making. Here in Florida, the sponsor of this terrible bill sent letters of recommendation to members of the committee to justify what he was trying to do. And the letter came from the American College of Pediatrics, which we know is a hate group, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, that in fact started as an organization in response in 2002, I believe it was, to the American Academy of Pediatrics, the larger group, had essentially made a policy position that they support same-sex parenting and they support LGBTQ couples adopting children. And so the American College of Pediatrics was created in opposition to that. Members of the Academy of Pediatrics deciding to form their own hate group. So what we did in the committee was, of course, we pointed out the hateful origins of the only so-called medical organization that was supporting taking away life-saving healthcare from trans youth. And we found that to be very effective. And of course, when you compare that to the number of national healthcare organizations and medical organizations that publish guidelines and approve this type of life-saving care for transgender youth, it was hard for even many of our Republican opponents to deny that they had a credibility issue. When you have the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Psychological Association, the American Medical Association, the Pediatric Endocrinology Society, all of these groups that all agree that offering puberty blockers and other forms of life-saving care for trans youth is something that is appropriate and something that is, in fact, very, very helpful for trans youth. It was hard for some of our opponents to deny the experts coming in, because at the end of the day, these bills are about politicians inserting themselves between patients and doctors, politicians trying to say that they know what medical care is best for someone else's child. And in states like Florida, unfortunately, we find that when we lead a lot of the time with the argument that this is just wrong and that transgender youth certainly deserves dignity and respect and access to life-saving care, this is all true and important, but in Republican legislatures as well, sometimes you have to really get into the science of it and the rhetoric of not allowing government to insert itself in between patients and their doctors, and we found that to be effective. This bill ended up only having a workshop, which meant the scheduled hearing and subsequent vote on the bill was canceled, and there was no vote that took place. Essentially killed the bill, but having folks in the Capitol there to be able to tell their story, even though there was not the imminent threat of an immediate vote, was very, very important, because it helped set the stage for what we think may come in future legislative sessions in Florida.
Thank you, Rep. Smith. So as we think about additional fights in new states, unfortunately, anti-trans legislation has been introduced in over 17 states already. We still have many more months to go in most legislative sessions, and some will go throughout the year. I'd love to just ask a follow-up question to each of you, and maybe we can go round robin, Chase, Katrina, and Rep. Smith, about additional resources that legislators can and should access so they can help prepare and so they can be the best allies possible as they enter in or finish out legislative session.
Thank you to Representative Smith, because having people who are leading the fight within committees, who are getting, access to the resources is critical. So I would say on the healthcare side, every major medical association has statements out opposing these bills. So getting access to those, also those medical associations have chapters in the states who can come and testify. So making sure that there's friendly lawmakers in the committees that are hearing the bills are coordinating on the ground so that right people are coming to testify. And same is true on the athletic side. Oftentimes in these states, the athletic association that is charged with regulating sports in the state opposes the legislation. They have other rules already that have been in effect. In many of the states where these bills have been heard, the sponsors of the bills have been able to, when asked, point to zero examples of a problem. So making sure to get the proponents of the legislation to admit that there is no actual problem that they're trying to solve is another thing that's incredibly helpful. Noting that this is also a coordinated, centralized effort. These are not homegrown bills. These are bills that are being pushed by national groups like Alliance Defending Freedom, Heritage Foundation. They have drafted the bills. They are pushing the bills. These are not bills that are being developed in states, and making sure that people are pointing that out. And lastly, one thing I would note too is all of these bills are illegal and will be subject to legal challenge. So if Republican lawmakers in particular are concerned about costs, these are the litigation over this type of legislation would cost millions of dollars. It's high expert fee litigation, high attorney fee litigation. That's going to take a long time and cost a lot of money, and the taxpayers would pay.
Thanks, Chase. Always a good reminder from our friends at the ACLU. Next we'll go to Katrina. Additional resources that legislators should orient to as they look at defeating anti-trans legislation in their state.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a couple of interesting things that legislatures can look to. One is the International Olympic Committee policy, just again, as a kind of resource of what's happening at the top level of sport. The NCAA, which governs collegiate sport in the US, also has a more expansive and inclusive kind of regulation than what's being proposed in the current regulations or what's being suggested in the Connecticut case. Youth sport in Canada, which is the equivalent of the NCAA, has a gender identity only inclusion policy that's happening at the collegiate level. So we have plenty of examples where the sky has not fallen. For more work, I don't expect legislators to be able to parse through all of the research on testosterone. My website has a lot of different writings around that. I'm happy to engage with people and send them writings. There's a chapter in my current co-authored book on the complexity of athleticism itself and its relationship to testosterone, and underscores why it is that these studies have said there is no clear, consistent relationship between testosterone and athleticism, which is based in many, many studies in the sports science literature. But of course, this is not convenient knowledge for the people who are creating these regulations. So they oversimplify and ignore and even contradict what's known in the science. So I would say those are some really great places to start in terms of trying to get more information and correct information out there.
Thank you, Katrina. Rep. Smith, any additional resources or tools that are helpful for other legislators to orient towards as they take on these battles?
Sure. So I want to echo what Chase was saying before, actually, about how many resources exist from all of the national medical associations who publish guidelines for how to care for transgender youth, which has been extremely powerful in combating some of these bad bills that try to criminalize this type of life-saving care. What's also really, really important is what often happens is proponents of these bad bills want to pull folks into an in-depth conversation about the types of healthcare and the types of procedures that are being done. They do this intentionally because they know that many of the folks who are standing with families and with trans youth sometimes don't know a lot of the details behind what type of care is being offered. So what I would always recommend is we are talking about access to life-saving care as an important alternative and necessary form of care that prevents transgender youth from being vulnerable and susceptible to disproportionate rates of suicide, depression, and substance abuse. There are many studies that exist, one that was published very recently that is a very, very important resource for lawmakers. It was published in Pediatrics, which is the official journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it essentially talks about how access to puberty blockers for trans youth is directly connected to a lower risk of suicide, which is very, very important because they often want to talk about bogus side effects that don't exist or health consequences for trans youth having access to care that has not been proven. And at the end of the day, which is worse is what I asked in committee. Side effects from hormonal therapy or increased risk of suicide as a result of being unable to access this care and unable to properly manage gender dysphoria. That is a very, very important and something that's relevant to remember for those lawmakers who are fighting these bills in legislatures across the country.
Thank you, Rep. Smith. And I want to, again, just extend our appreciation to the experts today. You've given us insights, and all of the legislators within our network, insights on research, on policy, on strategy, and coalition partners that can help us push for affirming policy for trans youth and to battle back against the attacks we see today. I just want to say, from Six's perspective, we're standing here with you all in this fight and encourage legislators to be bold advocates and reach to the resources that were offered in this video conversation. We'll have links to the ACLU's bill tracker, fact sheet, and talking points, in addition to some of the additional components that were mentioned here by Katrina. If you need anything in regards to these kinds of attacks, please reach out to us at helpdesk@stateinnovation.org, and we can get you in contact with the experts who are leading the charge here. Again, thank you so much to our team, and best of luck.